Welcome to Adult Siblings Versus, a podcast where a grown-ass brother and sister put aside their childhood rivalry in order to review nostalgic pieces of pop culture. I'm your co-host, Jason S. Leverett.
And I'm your other co-host, Ariel Leverett.
Well, Ariel, we are doing a very special episode, doing something a little different than we have done. We are doing our first requested episode.
Ooh.
A listener by the name of Nikki asked us to review Ever After, the Drew Barrymore vehicle from 1998, as a birthday present.
Happy birthday!
Yes, happy birthday, Nikki. Assuming we get this episode out, her birthday is May 18th. So assuming we get it out before then yes, happy birthday.
I'll do an alternative. Happy belated birthday!
Yes, if it's if it's the 18th or before, happy birthday. If it's after the 18th, sorry about that. Happy belated birthday. we're actually kind of bending ourselves a little backwards to make sure we get this as close to that as possible. So hopefully nothing goes wrong. But, you know, life happens. But in any event, we are going to be looking at this film, which thankfully is a film that we did watch a good chunk when we were growing up. More you, because yeah. This movie came out right before I started high school.
This movie is aimed for, like my demographic. Like, it was 1998, and I think this movie is made for, 8 to 10-year-old girls in 1998.
I mean, there was definitely a penis boner reference there, so that's not my favorite thing in the world to hear.
Well, I just think I think I've always kind of disliked the word inkling because of this movie, but that's neither here nor there.
Mm. So we're doing this request. Now, this is not something that we're going to be able to do all the time, but if you yourself would like us to look at a movie that you like, you can shoot us an email at adultsiblingsversus@gmail.com. Now, if it's something that we are familiar with, and more importantly, something that we can easily get, mm-hmm. It does up the chances of us doing it. But I will say that if we get enough people trying to get us to review things, that might be what causes us to invest in a Patreon account, to be perfectly frank, as time is money, money is power, power is pizza. So we have to not push ourselves too far to the brink. But, you know.
So get those requests in now while it's free, baby.
Yeah. Also, feel free to tweet at us. We're at Twitter at Adult Versus, and we also have a Facebook account. Now, Ariel, my nostalgia of Ever After is you putting in Ever After and me rolling my eyes and going like, ugh, and then just walking away. But can you talk to me a little bit about your nostalgia for this film?
My nostalgia is, pretty costumes, pretty settings, girl power-ish nostalgia. More Angelica Houston, and yeah. You know, that's never a bad thing. It's a good movie for girls being like, I'm an independent woman and I don't need no man, kind of thing.
Okay, sure. I mean, like, it is a movie about two people falling in love and whatnot. So, I guess she does need a man in the end.
We'll get into this. Okay. But she soups don't.
Okay. Yeah, so let's get into it a little bit. Now, I have to tell you that I could not find a ton of information about the production of this film. It was directed by Andy Tennant, with the screenplay by Tennant, Susan Grant, and then Rick Parks. Obviously, it is based off of the Cinderella fairy tale. Basically, it is I don't want to say a modern retelling, although it kind of is modern. Like, if you watch it, it does kind of have a modern feeling towards it. But
it feels 90s to me.
It's supposed to be a historically accurate version of the Cinderella story. I mean, it's not. We'll get into that.
It's like if Cinderella was a historical fiction.
Yes. Yes, it's and if half the characters were black, this would be Bridgerton. I couldn't find a whole lot of details of how this movie came to be, per se. I can tell you that Andy Tennant is a director who has done a good chunk of movies. A lot of them we have not done. It looks like his directorial debut, as far as like cinema goes, was the Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen film It Takes Two.
Ooh, I mean, I definitely did see that.
Yeah, he also did Fools Rush In, which was my introduction to Selma Hayek. And that's a movie I actually liked a lot when it came out, and I have not watched it in many years.
Yeah, I feel like it's been probably like 10 or 15 years since I've seen that movie, but I remember liking it.
Yeah, more for that for me. Yeah, I saw this before Desperado, so this is my first introduction to Selma Hayek. He did Sweet Home Alabama too, which is another movie that I saw and liked. So he's definitely got like a romantic comedy thing going on.
Mm.
And that's the last movie of his that I saw. He also did Hitch, which I categorically refused to watch at the time.
I did see. Not only did I see Hitch, but my freshman year in college, the freshman greeting weekend, the real Hitch came and did a talk, which is weird for freshmen.
The last movie he did, which is what makes me wonder if this guy is someone who I want to be friends with. I think the answer is no. But he apparently did a movie based off of the self-help book The Secret, called The Secret, Dare to Dream. This is back in 2020. I will say this about Drew Barrymore. 1998, she was having kind of a moment at the time. Like, she has been working since she was a child, since her big coming out at an E.T., the extraterrestrial, like back in the 80s. She's never not worked, but I feel like there was like a period of time in the 90s where like she was just kind of around but not really starring in too much stuff. But then like suddenly in the late 90s, it all kind of changed. Like, for example, this year, 98, this movie came out, which she was absolutely the star of. But this is also the same year that The Wedding Singer came out, the Adam Sandler film, which was like the movie right before his career really took off. It was like people were like, oh, Adam Sandler, that's pretty good. And then the next year, he became like a big star with whatever movie he did after that. But Wedding Singer was still like a really popular.
Well, I feel like, isn't this around, like, she was in, was it Scream or something? Like some horror movie.
Yeah, she was in Scream. She was in Scream the year before. But the thing about Scream, she was, or not the year before, I guess it was 2 years. I guess it was actually 2 years before this. So I wouldn't even know if I count it in there. But it was like, but she was actually only in Scream for literally the first scene of the film before her character is killed off. That was kind of the joke.
Never Been Kissed is the next year. So
yeah, that's what I was looking for. Never Been Kissed is like coming out there, and then Charlie's Angels is coming around the corner, like 2000. But Scream is kind of funny because the whole marketing for Scream was built around the idea that Drew Barrymore is starring in it, and then they kill her off in the first scene. And fun trivia, they did that because she had a unexpected conflict in her schedule, so she couldn't do the whole film. But then they both side agreed it'd be great if she could just do that one scene, and still funny if they face the whole marketing. But yeah. Anyway, this podcast is not about Scream. I've never seen Scream.
Me neither.
No point in doing that. But this is about Ever After. Like, I assume someone thought, what if we make a Cinderella story that was feminist, and this is what they came out with. This is the only thing I can think of, and didn't have fairy godmother. Leonardo da Vinci is the fairy godmother.
yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. So Ariel, since I don't have much to talk about today, how about you just go ahead and tell us a little bit about what happened to this movie? Seeing as how that as soon as this movie was put in at my house, I was like, oh, man, and then walked in my room and then didn't watch it.
Classic young boy. Okay, this movie starts in the 19th century. You see the scene of a grandame in France who has invited the Brothers Grimm over for a chat, and she does not like the way that they portray Cinderella. It's very inaccurate, and they're like, I mean, you know, folklore's gonna folk, you know? But she's like, oh no, here's a glass slipper. And they're like, what? And she's like, aha. And then she proceeds to tell the real story of Cinderella. Her name was Danielle. And we go cut to like Renaissance era France. And Danielle is like an 8-year-old living her fullest life. She's a tomboy and strong-willed and beats the shit out of her neighbor Gustav. Yeah. Her dad, who was a widow, comes home with his new wife, the Baroness de Ghent, and her two daughters, Marguerite and Jacqueline, and they're super fancy. And you can already tell that the Baroness seems to be a bit stuck up and mean, but you don't know to what extent yet. But her dad seems super, super nice and likes to bring her books and seems very kind. But that, of course, that means he has to die. So he has a heart attack, leaves them all behind. His last words is saying, I love you, to Danielle and not the Baroness. And I think she holds that grudge forever. Cut to, she's an adult and the Baroness has completely made her a servant in her own home. They are out of money. The Baroness keeps selling things, including her servants. Danielle has a run-in with the prince who is stealing a horse. He gives her money for silence. She uses said money to save one of the servants, but she dresses like a noble to do that. And basically, shenanigans ensue because everyone starts knowing her as this Nicole de Lancre, a countess, and the prince meets her, and he's all like, oh my god, you have brain thoughts, and I am into it. And yeah, they fall in love, and then you got Cinderella stuff happening, and Da Vinci is there, because, you know, why not? Yeah.
Leonardo da Vinci shows up as a fictional character a lot in films, and to the point that it's kind of weird. I feel like the only other character the historical figure I can think of who gets that treatment of just being a casual supporting character in so many fictional stories is like Tesla.
Yeah. Hmm.
Anyway, in addition for Leonardo DiCaprio. Oh my gosh. Leonardo da Vinci being in this film. There's also a distinct lack of magic in this story.
Mm-hmm.
As obviously being, there's also a lot of stuff that's supposed to be like historically accurate, but there's a lot of stuff that's not historically accurate. In fact, the whole romance between the two characters is very historically inaccurate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so this film, this is one of those things where I, a 37-year-old man in the year of our Lord 2022, trying to watch a film that was created in 1998 for 8 to 10-year-old girls.
I'll say 8 to 12.
8 to 13-year-old girls is not necessarily something that I can get too into, as it's so clearly not meant for me that most of the criticisms I can think of seems almost pointless, right? Like, but I will say that I do appreciate the film trying to make a film with a female protagonist who is a proper protagonist, like the hero of her own story.
Yeah.
Which is something that seems to be kind of hard for Hollywood in a lot of movies like this, where like even if the main character is theoretically a young lady who's, you know, going through adversity, oftentimes he's someone who is pushed by the plot and needs to be rescued by a man. I think that just a more conscious effort was put into making the character Danielle in this have more agency in her story than otherwise happens in a lot of similar stories. And part of that might be because Drew Barrymore is she's not a minor person in Hollywood at this point, right? So like getting her is probably a fairly big deal, and like maybe she wouldn't have been interested in just playing like the hapless victim character. But so much of the film revolves around Danielle being smart, clever, and not afraid to call people out on their shit, that I think And most importantly, she gets into a situation where she's basically kidnapped and the prince comes to rescue her, and he comes just after she rescues herself.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, that is by far probably like the best moment of the movie.
Absolutely. This movie was not really clicking for me, but then when that scene happens and I realized what was going on, like, oh boy, I was like, yes, that's fantastic. That is absolutely exactly what I want to see in this type of film. And then she's not even like, they didn't even make a huge deal about it either. It's not like she's going like, oh, well, you're a little too late. No, she's touched that he came to rescue her, even though she just didn't need it. Yeah, that's okay to be touched.
Yeah.
It's kind of a matter of fact. I like that part a lot. I think historically speaking, I think Henry actually did marry the Spaniard.
Probably. Although that whole moment with I didn't mention this in the summary, but while Danielle's going through all her stuff, you have Prince Henry, who is supposed to be he's betrothed to a Spanish princess, and when he finds out the truth about Danielle, he's all fussy. He agrees to, marry the princess, and their wedding scene, and she's just crying like crazy, and then like you see like her like homely lover in the audience crying too, and that whole thing, it was a lot.
I kind of wish I had a bit more context there, because like, is she the princess of Spain? I mean, that's what I assume, right?
That's what I assumed. Who else would she be?
Well, okay, so she could be a princess, but she also could be another close relative of the royal family as well. But I don't. But my point is, if she is a princess of Spain, which you assume, right? It's the simplest answer. Like, did she just cause an enormous controversy by making out with whoever that was in the crowd? Now, he must have been important enough to be there. So he was probably not, he's probably noble himself, but he's just going to be executed when they get back to Spain, right? Like, that's just, he's dead.
Well, yeah, and totally. And but this is, ever after universe. So, and considering the Prince Henry's, like, dynamic with his parents, it'll probably, I don't think anyone's going to be moited for it. But, like, I think the point is that she is definitely the princess, because the way that the king and queen of Spain react and the way that the king and queen of France are start laughing, like, oh, we're not the only ones with, like, problems with our child. I mean, we thought our shit was bad, but look at that. So, like, I think she has to be a princess.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure. I wonder what the Pope has to say about all this.
Divorce is only something they do in England.
That's an interesting joke there, because obviously he's referencing the Church of England and Henry VIII.
Yeah.
I don't remember the timeline that Henry VIII was in power.
Well, pre-Renaissance, because if you're thinking about like a Renaissance being like Elizabethan England.
Sure.
It's definitely a relatively recent enough occurrence to talk about it. But yeah, it definitely has like happened.
Sure. Okay. So watched this a lot when we were kids. Movie more for you. I'm sure you have thoughts. Some thoughts on it that would probably be a bit more relevant than my old man's Nicanery.
Yeah. And I will definitely say, as a grown ass person in the year of our Lord 2022, this does hit different. Like it's not, I don't favor it nearly as much as I did as a child in 1998. But like, I remember, this movie came out in a time that I was very much into watching movies of like period pieces. Like I really enjoyed the scenery and the costumes and that kind of thing of like these different movies, like set in whatever year, because I also was like super into the Secret Garden and blah blah blah. A lot of things that maybe that really do reflect like me becoming an actor, and then I get to just like be in plays where I get to wear these outfits that I always found so interesting. And so I was very into just like the look of this movie. It's a great movie for costumes. But I feel like, you know, anyone who is a little more of an outsider when it comes to like, at this point, you know, you're starting to get to the point where you have people who like girls who are considered like pretty and interesting. And you have discovered that you are not one of those girls. You're decidedly not the pretty and interesting girl to people. And so you start gravitating to stories that have a person who is a bit on the outside of like that. And so you have Marguerite, who is supposed to be like the pinnacle of like beauty and stuff, and of like, of course the prince would want her. And then you have, you know, dirty ass Danielle hanging out, getting truffles with a pig, and who likes to read. And you're like, yeah, that's me. I feel like you want to say that Danielle is you, but like, really, you're Jacqueline. And now I'm like a complete Jacqueline stand.
Oh, yeah. I feel like she was pretty popular in our household even then.
Yeah, I think so. I think I even then sense that, like, as much you want to be like, oh, yeah, I'm totally a Danielle with all these opinions and shit. And it's like, no, Jacqueline really, like, sees my soul. And like, and also as a kid, especially like as I like was entering like adolescence and stuff, like someone who had trouble with weight and then like was sometimes made to feel bad about my weight, like I feel Jacqueline. And like, who, by the way, not big. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're big or not. That's not a problem. But they also are like picking on her for literally nothing.
Yeah, I think her crime is that she's not as thin as her sister. Not super
skinny. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which
is like, oh, you're not as thin as like as your super skinny blonde sister. You must be fat. Raw. God.
Yeah. Which also feels very 90s to me. Because they don't really like, they have that whole thing, but they don't challenge it at all. Like, they have that as an element where everyone keeps like, her mom keeps like giving her shit about eating, but like besides the end of it, like, I'm just here for the food, mom, that's kind of all you get. But yeah,
she might have snacked a little bit during the masquerade.
I mean, sure, who wouldn't?
I sure would. No, I'm just saying, like, I think the way that the movie frames it, that would be the thing. And you know what, actually, is she, her love interest, if you could call it that, is definitely an overweight guy. There you go. The movie's telling us that two fat people in love.
Exactly. Like that, and once again, a very like kind of 90s bullshit, where it's just like, oh yeah, she's kind of big, so she'll date the other kind of, like, she's kind of a big sidekick, so she'll date the other big sidekick, because like, chunky people belong together in the background. Like, it ain't it, you know. Annoying.
Also, isn't that guy a servant?
Yeah, it seems like, I would assume that he is like kind of like the head of like the prince's guard or something, you know, like, it seems like he's in charge of, like, I don't know, like, he seems like to be some kind of like right hand man, which I guess for a prince is like as close as you get to a friend, like basically like your head handmaiden or your head like guard guy is as close.
He's Arsenio Hall.
Your Arsenio Hall is as close as you get to a friend when you're royalty.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, the guy must be some sort of nobility of some sort, because he is allowed to just be at the masquerade in costume, which I don't think they would have let up just a random servant, even if they were an important servant.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's what, like, those positions, like, the head, like, the head handmaiden or whatever for, like, a princess would be noble. Like, those are noble positions.
Okay. I don't know nothing about it. The only thing I know about nobility is everything I learned from Downton Abbey. And those maids were not allowed to go to the parties.
See, had you watched The Tudors, you would have known.
I did watch The Tudors for, like, the first season, and it was just too sexy.
I think the thing that, like, I still, you know, appreciate it, because especially at this time, you don't get a lot of it, is the fact that you have this main character who, like, throughout the story, she does not need Henry. She's, like, yes, like, he helps her, you know, get Maurice out by being like, I'm the prince, blah, blah, blah. But, like, you know what? She was doing it for herself, and she wasn't giving up. And I think she still would have figured out a way to save Maurice. Like, she wasn't, like, walking away from that, like, whatever that guy's title is, the jailer? I don't know. But, like...
The slave monger?
Yeah. She wasn't walking away from him with her tail between her legs. She was still at the fight when she was interrupted by the prince. And I liked that she found his, like, ignorance and, like, kind of easygoing nature about things that really matter. Like, she found him really annoying. And I, even in the end, like, it wasn't his love that, like, gave her confidence in herself. You know, like, no. it was, like, the power of her her loved ones lifting her up and helping her see, like, what she is. And she was constantly, like, you know, the scene where she, like, you know, picks him up in a fireman carry and, like, that kind of thing is a little on the nose. But, like...
Yeah. I thought it was cute, though.
But it was cute. Scene. But, yeah. And yeah. She is ready to, and, like, as we said, the last moment where, like, she saves herself. She doesn't even need Henry to save her in the end. And I think if Henry had never come back and been like, JK, I love you, I mean, right there, Danielle was free. And I think she probably would have still tried to find a way to help her friends at her home and done something. Like, you know, like, I think for a 90s movie and for a kid who is fairly impressionable, it's like, you know, it's a good enough message. And, like, I would still let a kid watch it today.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there's anything. Well, there's one thing that's a little offensive. And that is the Romani people depicted.
Yes. So there would probably need to be a discussion about that. But at least she acknowledges, I mean, the terminology is not great. Like, they are still using the slur of gypsy. But she even acknowledges the fact that, like, people see these travelers a certain way that they have to be beholden to. Like, she acknowledges the fact that it's like, you have, like the royalty and stuff like that have, like, looked at them as criminals when they clearly aren't, and they have, and they spend time with them, and, like, you know, Henry learns something and then invites them to the party. So, like, at least they still, like, address that, like, this group of people are, like, wrongfully criminalized.
Although they are still robbing people.
I mean, like, well, we all know about what happens.
No, I understand. But my point, I suppose, comes to the idea that, like, if someone tried to rob me, but they were desperate, I'm still not 100% certain I invite them to court for a masquerade ball.
Well, if someone tried to rob me, but then by the end of the night we totally get drunk together and I have a really good time with them, I don't know.
Okay, yeah. Well, okay. Let me put it this way: I don't think Henry's the type of person to do that, based on what we know about him. If you're the type of person that, like, freaks out that badly about Danielle being a peasant, I find it hard to believe that he's like, oh, yeah, these are my bandit friends.
I mean, I think his reaction to her, I think, is beyond the, like, I know he says, it's like, you're a peasant and blah, blah, blah. I think it's the fact that he just went through a heartbreak thinking that she was engaged to someone else and was gone. And now it's like, and he goes right back up to an immediate high seeing her again, and then goes right back down because there's another lie, and a lie that is happening in front of everyone. The idea that's like, not just that, oh, she's a peasant, so I'm mad. Oh, all of these people are going to talk about this, and like she's put me in this position, and this is all happening very fast, and I am super pissed, and I guess this is the thing I'm going to latch on to. I don't think that like the real hurt is like you're a peasant. I think it's more than that. I think it's just what he says.
Well, he was kind of trash talking peasants earlier, but I will say that he kind of was a victim of his own hubris there, because she's like, hey, can we talk? He's like, no, time to talk. You got to meet my parents. Rah! Like, no, oh, yeah. I really think it's important that we talk. No, it's not.
Yeah, he
is. That was a direct quote, by the way.
Yeah, he is horribly self-centered. And all he cares about is his own stuff. I mean,
yeah, Danielle is a much better character than Henry.
Oh, yeah, by far. I mean, like, you know, if he had that kind of personality, like, and this was like, if this was a story actually set in modern times and that dynamic, I'd be like, oh, she's too good for him. But, you know, this is Renaissance France. So, like, yes, marry the prince. Like, that's, you do that. And she definitely seems to have enough influence on him that she actually could legitimately help the kingdom. So, like, yes, even if he's kind of a dumb baby boy, it's the right move.
A dumb baby boy who looks like he's 35.
Yeah. Oh, no, dumb baby boy in his brain development, not in looks.
No. Yeah, I just wanted to
throw that in there. He looks old as hell. I didn't actually look to see how old, because she is like 23 at this point, but I didn't actually look to see how old he would have been.
Baby face Drew Barrymore.
I know. She looked very young. Like the first image of her in the field or whatever, and she gets up, it's like, oh wow. She's supposed to play like an 18-year-old, so 23. That's pretty good for 90s standards. But like, yeah, she looks like such a baby. And that's saying something, considering that like she's actually, we could be watching E.T. where she legitimately practically looks like a baby.
Yeah. I don't know if we're ever gonna do E.T.
I mean,
I've only actually seen that movie like once or twice all the way through.
It's just gonna be like 2 hours of us going like, God, I just, so scary to me.
it's gonna be like like 1 hour and 50 minutes or 55 minutes of me watching the movie, then 5 minutes of me just being super angry about all these damn walkie talkies in the place of guns. All right. Anyway, I just want to point up some stuff that kind of bothered me before we get too far away from this conversation. You know, this isn't, I guess, stuff that's bothered me, but I remember this movie being way more serious when we were young. Like, I watched this film and it's like, this is wacky. This is a pretty wacky film.
Yeah.
Like, from just the way that the royals interact with the non-royals to, like, the class differences between various characters that is sometimes, like, really important and sometimes it's a joke. Like, and then like the tone, the lines, the dialogue, you know, it's all kind of like this isn't Robin Hood Men in Tights, but this is closer to Robin Hood Men in Tights than I was expecting.
Yeah, there are multiple times throughout this movie where you can hear like the 90s modernness in the lines that I found pretty darn annoying. And then you have to cross it with the times where Drew Barrymore just like kind of drops her accent along with that, and you're like, ugh, yeah, this is this is exhausting.
Like, for a movie that's supposed to be like, oh, this is the historically accurate version of this story, of this fairy tale, you think it might be a bit more serious. It's not. It's still just like a fun romp with the stakes not being as high as you'd think. But, you know, that's not, like, again, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I just was a little taken aback by it because I remember it being more serious. I guess I was a very serious 13-year-old is the problem.
I also think relative to, like, I think relative to other kids' movies we were watching, this is on this more serious side. So, you know, less serious now considering whatever else we're watching. But I think in the realm of, like, kid stuff, sure. This was a little more serious.
Okay. Speaking of this being a historically accurate version of Cinderella, it's not. and I bet you can... We could make a list of all things that are definitely wrong, but there was one thing in particular that kind of stood out to me, in that the book Utopia was published 3 years before Leonardo da Vinci died. So the timeline there just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense at all. And there's, like, a lot of little things there. I will say that the major thing, there's stuff, you know, that didn't draw me in, right? But again, it wasn't for me. But the one thing that really bothered me about this film is a pet peeve that I'm realizing that I have. Like, I've got probably many pet peeves, but I think this podcast has made me realize I have two major pet peeves when it comes to these sort of things. Like, pet peeve number one, did they cast a fake singer to make me think that the main character is actually singing in a musical? We've talked about that a lot of times. This is not a musical, so this can come up, but the other pet peeve I've noticed I have is English, or the English accent as the European accent.
Thank you. Let's talk about it. I hate it.
And it's actually, like, doubly upsetting because it's not consistent, because her dad has a bad French accent in the beginning of the film. And so there's some people do, but, like, most of the people here have some sort of English accent. And it's really weird. I mean, like, I don't know. I just don't like the idea of us kind of, like, just say if we need something in Europe, just have someone fake a British accent and then it's fine. No one will notice. This movie is 100% taking place in France. They are very, well, okay, they imply to be very French. There's a lot of French, like, things, a lot of French slipped into the dialogue. People get called Mademoiselle. A lot, but they're all speaking in the British accent, English accent, excuse me. They're all talking the English accent, and it drives me up the wall. Even the Americans are faking that accent. Why? You know, if we're going to not do French accent, which I get, you may not want to try to imitate a French accent for the entire film, but why not just not bother with the accent at all?
Yeah, like, what made it so the thing to do is just an English accent? Because it also, because it's annoying, because then you have, like, the servants with their kind of lower class provincial English accents going on alongside the other characters, English RP. And it's just like, it's, yeah. And mind you, you do have a fair amount of British actors in this movie as well.
Yes.
But it's just, yeah. It's always annoyed me. I think it annoyed me then, because I feel like I remember us having this conversation and you having a very similar rant when you were young.
It always bothers me every time I see it. It bothered me in Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, because, like, at least that was a musical that starred on the West End. They were English people doing this musical. So it's like, for them, sure. Yeah, British accents. You yourselves are British. And keeping that, sure. Whatever. But, like, this...
You know what two examples I think did okay without bothering me this way? Mm. Beauty and the Beast and Hunchback of Notre Dame, with both take place in France. And most of the people just, like, talk with their normal accent. Except for the Candlestick, who... And the feather duster, who are both French, and they're, like, the only French people there. And I think the clock has a British accent, but I think everybody else just speaks American.
Everyone's just like, you got
Angela Lansbury's in that. So
well, yeah. Probably, so she's just one. You let Angela Lansbury do whatever she wants to do, obviously. And then I love that it really does seem like, it's like, you just gotta let Jerry Orbach fly, you know?
He just gotta let him fly. He's very close to selling his soul to Law and Order, so let's give him a little bit of freedom before that takes hold. Speaking of accents, as you said, Drew Barrymore didn't maintain hers all the way through. Even though I thought Drew Barrymore did really well in this film, I thought that she was a little held back by having to do that accent.
Yeah, I said, and this I suppose is getting a little into characters, but
unless you have anything else to talk about the movie itself, we could probably just go into characters now.
Yeah, I think the last thing I had was literally the, in my notes, old trope, all of Europe equals England. So that's it.
Yeah. Okay.
I agree with your sentiment that, like, you know, I think she's doing pretty darn well in general, but like her California girl definitely falls out, particularly when she's in heightened emotion. And like, as a person who has had to study dialects and has had to do an English RP accent, and sometimes dipping into other regions of England, doing accents, right? Like, oh man, I had to do, there was like a play where my dialect coach was trying to get me to do a Yorkshire accent, which is essentially Jodie Whittaker from Doctor Who. Like, I had to like do that accent. I was just like, you are killing me, Smalls. But I noticed like a thing that can be difficult for people doing an English RP accent is maintaining it when they get loud. It's a lot easier to keep those R's soft and to remember to keep your resonance in the front of your mouth when you're speaking relatively softly. And then when you get loud, you start going back to that old habit of like having your resonance in the back of your mouth, and the all like your weird roundness comes back that is very American, and like you can hear it multiple times with Drew Barrymore, like when she calls someone like a tub of guts when she's screaming at Marguerite, and you're just like, okay, I guess we just American now. And it's, yeah, she has troubles.
Another person who fakes an English accent in this film, but I think does a lot better at it, is Angelica Houston.
Morticia's back, baby!
Yeah, oh man. So I did not remember she was in this until it came up. I think you may have mentioned it. So I was like, oh, she's going to be, that's going to be fine. Or maybe I saw it in the, when I was looking at it. Anyway, the point is, I spent the last however many decades not thinking about Angelica Houston being in this film. And so what a pleasant surprise to see her here. She's playing a much different character than Morticia, but Angelica Houston is very good at acting, so she can play a lot of different characters.
Well, like, I think Angelica Houston is so good at playing a person with gravitas and having, and just being a heightened character. And I think she pretty much embraces this weird world and chews it on up with the rest of them. I love, like, from the get, I am very much invested in her acting at this. And because I always, like, even as a kid, I always found it so intriguing. In the beginning, you're not sure if she actually likes her dad or not, you know. And when he dies and she runs after him and she's crying, don't leave me here. And you think about the idea that, you know, she's probably a widow, I assume, you know, and she has these two kids. She probably has, considering what a schemer she is with Marguerite, I mean, she probably was like working that dating scene for a minute and probably super didn't want to be in this provincial place, but she's like, at least I have security. And the idea that she gets there and instantly loses that, and just like, you just left me here to just freaking what? And I think she just plays that really well. And the look that she gives Danielle as as her dad, Auguste, as he's dying, he looks at Angelica, he's like on the ground. He looks at Angelica Houston for a second and then like looks back at his daughter and says, you know, I love you so much, and he dies. Which, reasonable. It's his daughter. She's been at this game for 8 years. Sure.
I just realized the actor who plays the father is Dutch. So he might not have been, it might not have been that he's doing a bad French accent. He just might have had a Dutch accent, and I'm a ugly American.
That does, oh gosh. I remember, that actually makes me think of watching Moon Knight, and I was trying to figure out, like, Layla, her, the actress's accent, because at first I was like, what's with your weird English accent? And I was like, oh god, she's Egyptian. This is just, she's just doing, she just like, it's from a different place. And I felt dumb.
You know, I actually don't think Angelica Houston chose the scenery too much in this film, in the sense that I think that most of the actors here kind of knew the assignment. I think she did as well. She's not like you know, eating that set piece like some of the other standouts in some of the movies that we've been watching lately. Mm-hmm. You know, but I feel like if she was more intense or everyone was a little less silly, I think it would have been more that. I think she just is. He uses her ability of being Angelica Houston to really have a really sense of grandeur of the character, and really seems to be good at kind of playing evil, because she's kind of almost subtle in her evilness. Actually,
that is very fair. I have to say, I love her subtle smirks when she hurts Danielle, like when she gives a cutting comment that clearly lands with Danielle. She'll give this little smirk about her victory with it that I love. When you're near the end and Danielle is like, did you ever actually love me? Was there, like, you're basically the only mother I've ever known. Was there ever a moment that you felt any kind of affection towards me? And the Baroness, Angelica Houston, says, who could love a pebble in her shoe? And obviously, this hurts her. This hurts Danielle a lot, and she just kind of walks away. It's like, of course. And as she walks away, Angelica Houston gives this little smile, this little smirk about like cutting her like that. And it's just like, ooh, you so good at this.
I kind of want to know the details of how the Baroness and Danielle's father got together. I can make an assumption, and we don't really need to know. I think we have all the clues to kind of draw our own conclusions, but I assume that Daniel's father is rich, but a peasant. Like, he's mm-hmm. no royal title, noble blood, but is a rich farmer.
Yeah, because I feel like he was leaving so often for, like, work, so maybe selling things or something like that, making deals.
Yeah, I assume. Meanwhile, based on the state of the farm 10 years later, we can assume that in addition to being a baroness who's very, very, very likely a widow to a baron, she's probably not good at managing money. So she was probably broke as hell, mm-hmm. Like when she met Danielle's father, which is probably why she married him. She probably, the way that Houston plays this character, it seems almost ridiculous that she would ever lower herself to marry a peasant unless she were broke. Yeah. She needed that cash money. 100%. She needed that sugar daddy. Mm-hmm. Like, who else is going to marry? Because, I mean, like, Angelica Houston is not, like, super young at this point. I think she might have been, like, in her late 40s, early 50s when this film was done. I don't know how old the character is supposed to be, but, like, she seems like an older widow with children. That's not somebody who is going to get married by the most prosperous, like, royal or whatever.
Yeah, 100%. Like, right. she's a woman without a lot of options, and she's just, you got a scheme in those moments. And I bet, you know, whatever city that he goes to do his business, I'm assuming, like, she was there probably because he's well off. He's probably been invited to these, like, parties and social gatherings with, like, these fancier people. And she saw an opportunity. And I'm sure, like, you can see how slinky she is. And so, like, I'm sure it was pretty easy for her to like, you know, slip into his good graces. And, yeah, I think that is definitely, like, she had no money and she needs to figure something out.
Right, yeah, I think so, too. You know, I actually was wondering if she actually had poisoned Danielle's father, but it never comes up of at all throughout the movie. I feel like if she had poisoned him, it would have been more hinted at. But he just dies so quickly. I just assumed that she was just like, well, I'm married now. I got his money. Gotta get rid of him. But no, doesn't come back up. So I'm assuming probably not.
I don't think so. Because...
yeah.
Because I think... because, like, it does seem like his money is from the work that he does. So, like, I don't... it doesn't seem like he's, like, wealthy. In the kind of way that without him, that money's gonna stick. And so I don't think it was her plan to lose that meal ticket like that.
Well, certainly the movie does not ever really come back to it. Anyway, yes. let's move on to the evil stepsisters, of which there's only one evil stepsister, and there's kind of a neutral, friendly leaning, and then more friendly as the movie goes along stepsister. Which, by the way, I don't know why. Like, for some reason, that dynamic of having one evil stepsister and one neutral stepsister made me like the family unit dynamic more than in just about any other Cinderella story I've ever seen.
I agree. I think it's more realistic. Because I don't think... I feel like the sibling dynamics makes more sense that way. I don't think you usually... I mean, maybe you do. I don't know. But it seems like you don't usually have, like, two siblings that are like, we are absolutely amazing together and whatever, just screw this one. I feel like there's usually more variation, you know? Like, everyone kind of has their role in the family. And yes, maybe it might be that for some horrible reason, one's a dud to the others and blah, blah, blah. But, like, I think you usually have more of, like, one's a total asshole, one's just trying to survive, and one's getting most of the shit. That feels more realistic to me.
All right, so we have Megan Dodds as Marguerite, who's the tall, lean one. Is she tall? And, she's lean and blonde.
Yeah, lean and blonde. Very stereotypical 1990s ideal of beauty.
Yeah, you know what? I actually think Jacqueline would probably be closer to the 16th century standard of beauty than
did honestly Marguerite, she legitimately looks like a Renaissance painting herself. Like, I think she 100% would be considered the ideal of beauty, and it's kind of weird that they're giving her so much shit.
No, they should they should have reversed it. It should have been Megan Dodds being told, like, oh, you're just too skinny, you're like a twig, and they throw bricks at her. and look at Jacqueline, like, oh, you're like a statue.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's very silly. I feel like at one point Gustav will paint her, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, I mean, like, there's not a lot to either of these characters. I think that Megan Dodds does a pretty good job with, like, being, like, you know, this paper-thin, I'm evil and pretty stepsister. By the way, Megan Dodds, it's been working this whole time, but I've apparently missed seeing her in every single thing she's ever been in.
I know.
As opposed to Melanie Lynskey, who plays Jacqueline, she's worked actually quite a bit more since, like, compared to her movie sister. And I have seen her in a bunch of stuff and just don't remember her is the problem. Like, I just saw Don't Look Up, which she is in, and I do not remember her being in that at all.
I remember when 2.5 Men were happening, which I didn't really watch. I think, like, every once in a while it would, like, show up on the TV and I might watch an episode. But I do remember being like, oh, it's Jack Lee from Ever After, and liking seeing that she was in a thing. But I didn't really watch that show. But also, shout out to Over the Garden Wall. She was the voice of Beatrice the Bird. If there was ever... I mean, I'm sure we'll eventually get to this kind of stuff, but if there was ever a thing to cover that is not necessarily nostalgic, because it happened in recent years, but I'm super into it and it still gives me nostalgia in a weird way, it would be Over the Garden Wall.
She's currently in this show, Yellow Jackets, which stars a lot of 90s it girls, all grown up and middle-aged.
I hear that show is very good.
Yeah, it's got... Juliette Lewis and Christina Ricci in that as well, and it's like So it's just like, let's try to find every 90s kid's crush and throw them in a TV show together.
I guess mission accomplished, because, yeah, I hear it. But was it on, like, Showtime or something?
I believe it's something that I'm not going to be able to watch yet.
Yeah, anytime someone talks about a show and it's like, it's so good, and they say it's like on Showtime or something, it's like, Showtime? It's like you don't even want me to watch it.
I feel that way about anytime someone brings up something on Apple TV.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, someone's like, I'll see a trailer for a show. It's like, wow, this is really hitting all of my buttons. This looks like it's something I'd really enjoy only on Apple TV. Oh, well, this isn't real.
Well, goodbye forever.
Jacqueline or Jacqueline. How is it pronounced?
Jacqueline.
Jacqueline. Jacqueline, she's a, like, she's mostly kind of this, like, weird contrast to Marguerite, and, like, there's not too much more to her there either. If there's one thing I wish the movie had a bit more of, is some sort of relationship being built between her and Danielle.
Yeah.
Right? Or, like, maybe they have a less subtle bond through their mutual but very different abuse from the Baroness.
Yeah.
But we don't get that much of it. So it's just something that would have given, like, the character a bit more meat, would have been nice. To be honest, most of the characters who aren't Danielle are kind of and aren't the Baroness, because, like, Houston's really good. They're kind of bland.
Yeah, not a whole lot to them. This isn't in contrast or whatever we're saying, but I do find the scene when Jacqueline is helping Danielle, dressing her wounds from being whooped the fuck up, that, like, she got them lashes. Yeah. She's
that took a dark turn. Yeah. Like, it was like a silly movie until suddenly there's whipping. I don't have much to talk about the rest of the cast, but I do want to shout out Toby Jones, who is, like, you know, England's greatest export, Toby Jones.
Also, Dr. Zola from the MCU.
Yeah, he has played a lot of things. He is the one of the greatest journeyman character actors, like, of modern time. It has been for decades. He can do anything, including playing a Nazi German mad scientist and Captain America. But he also played an evil version of the Doctor in Doctor Who, as he was the Dream Lord.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That was an interesting episode. There were so many things happening. Yeah, he was good.
Yeah, no, he's all around. And I saw that he was in this, and I was like, oh, great. And then I saw that he's playing a character that doesn't even have a name. He's just the Royal Page. This is gotta be kind of early days for old Mr. Jones.
I'd say so. Yeah, this is...
Yeah,
I would guess this is the first thing that I had seen him in.
Sure. God, it looks like he's going to be in Indiana Jones 5. Sure. Also, bad news, there's going to be Indiana Jones 5.
Yeah, that's good for him, bummer for all of us.
Yeah.
Let's see. Before we get away, because, okay, Prince Henry, Doug Ray Scott, he was boring.
Yeah.
King Francis, Timothy West. His moments of, like, cluelessness and stuff, it's funny, it's fine. I think he's fine. I do have to give a shout out to Queen Marie, Judy Parfitt, for You Call the Midwife stands. She is Sister Monica Joan, which I super did not make the connection. Well, like, I didn't make the connection when I started watching Call the Midwife, and as soon as I saw her, I'm like, holy fuck, this is a young, God bless her, that I could say that this version of her is like, this is a young Sister Monica Joan. For you who don't watch Call the Midwife and therefore do not cry on a regular basis, she is like the, like, elderly nun, like the one who's like her mind's gone, kind of going, and she basically, like, speaks in, like, scripture-like poetry all the time. Yeah. So it was exciting. And any time that the character, like the queen, said anything that sounded vaguely poetic, I was just like, oh, my Sister Monica Joan. And I have one more thing that I have to address. Do you have any other, like, character stuff that you want?
No, Toby Jones was the only shout-out I wanted to make.
I thought that was the only shout out I wanted to make. But then I realized, so Le Pew, the other bad guy, and so this is the dude who is just like, I mean, just sexual predator, Pierre Le Pew, who is just this hunting Danielle throughout the movie in just the worst way. And then at the end, the Baroness sells her to him, and he continues to make advances until she's like, I will cut you open. Let me out here. Give me that key. So that actor is Richard O'Brien. Richard O'Brien, as in Rocky Horror Show's Richard O'Brien, also aka Riff Raff in Rocky Horror Picture Show. So the guy who wrote Rocky Horror Show and also played Riff Raff in Rocky Horror Picture Show, that's who Le Pew is.
Fucking Riff Raff. Like, yeah, like, what a weird thing. So first of all, I am today years old when I realized that the guy who plays Riff Raff in the film is also the person who created the show.
Yeah.
So,
me too.
Number
and
one.
I feel real. I literally have been in that musical and I didn't fucking realize that.
And then also did not recognize Riff Raff, which I feel a little bad about that, as I've seen Rocky Horror Picture Show a bunch of times.
Which I think we should put down as one of the musicals we cover next year.
Maybe we'll do that. Well, someone's got to pick it. And you know what? The problem with us doing Rocky Horror Show is that it seems such an easy pick. It seems like there's other things I kind of would like to do.
I mean,
it feels like low-hanging fruit for me. Well, so that's why I never pick it.
Well, let's see. Because I feel like we've gone through quite a few musicals. I feel like by the time we get to next March, we'll see. We'll see how many we got in the holster.
I mean, I'm already like debating between like five.
Oh shit.
I only have slots for two. So like,
okay, well, damn. I guess if we pick it, it will be mine. But anyway.
No, this is crazy. I didn't think of this guy as being a guy who shows up in Hollywood movies.
Yeah.
But here he is. Also, he identifies as a third gender. I'm not 100% certain if that's similar to gender non-binary, but he does use he/him pronouns.
Well, that's interesting.
So it's all good. That's all good.
I think that, I mean, I feel like that makes sense, because I mean, everyone knows Rocky Horror Picture Show is such a gender-defying romp, and so I could see that stemming from just finding ways to express oneself in the fucking 70s, where you don't have a lot of opportunities to just be a person out in life, being like, yeah, I'm not digging just being a flat out man or a flat out woman. So that's interesting.
Wait a goddamn second. If the guy who created Rocky Horror Show is in the Rocky Horror Picture Show as Riff Raff, I have to assume he must have been involved in the film production. So how come Rocky doesn't talk? What the heck?
I mean,
the creator was right there. He was right there. He should have been like, hey, how come Rocky doesn't have a script? It's like, he doesn't need one. He doesn't talk.
I guess we'll find out whenever we cover it on our podcast.
I don't know. Maybe so. Anyway, back to the Rocky Horror Ever After show.
Just a little acknowledgement of the Leonardo da Vinci character.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Patrick Godfrey plays Da Vinci. I thought it was fun. Like, he's in it a lot, so I didn't want to just not mention him.
Yeah, I guess my thing is that I just found the character to be so nothing. Like, he's there, he helps move the plot along, but he's not interesting, and I'm also just sick. I'm sick of Leonardo da Vinci as a fictional character in these things. I'm just sick. I'm just tired. It's always the same thing. He's always this super helpful to the protagonist, and he's always this super inventor with all these crazy inventions that apparently never really existed, but may have been in his notes, and so we're just kind of making it up, and it's like, just tired. Like, he's magical. Leonardo da Vinci DiCaprio is always very magical, and it makes me tired. It makes me tired.
Like the artist version of the magical Negro. Like, very confusing. But yeah, I mean, he's an old guy who does some humorous stuff, and I'm like, yeah, you go for it. Yeah.
Let's move on. So we can talk about music. The problem being, so the film's closing song is Put Your Arms Around Me, performed by the rock band Texas, which is apparently a band that exists. But I didn't listen to it, so I don't have anything to add.
Yeah, I gotta say, didn't listen to it either. Didn't stick around those credits, so whoops.
So, Ariel, what would you give Ever After, also known as Ever After a Cinderella Story? Would you give it a thumbs up, a thumbs down, or a thumb somewhere in the middle?
That's a good question. What would I give this? It is not my most nostalgic piece of media that we've covered. I'm not as attached to it as I am other things. I think I enjoyed it fine, but I think I also would be fine never watching it again. So, like, I think it's probably, like, a high middle. Like, it's like, I would still be fine, like, watching this with a kid or something like that. But it's also still feels very 90s to me. I feel it in my guts. I don't think I would probably go out of my way to just watch this thing. So, like, high middle.
Okay, I'm going to give it a middle. Thumbs in the middle. More in the middle than you, maybe even a low middle. But basically, I didn't love this film. But again, this film is not for me. But I will say that my opinion of the film took a huge upswing when I realized that Danielle had saved herself from imprisonment.
She will cut you from navel to nose.
Yeah, he's like, you'll hang for this. Like, not if I kill you.
Yeah, I love that. Snap. Not if you're dead. So yeah, maybe it's just a thumbs up. That is so fun. I'll switch it. I'll let happiness reign. I'll give it a thumbs up.
All right, cool. That's gonna do it for us this week. So next time, we're gonna do something that I've been wanting us to do since very early on in this podcast existence. So we're going to return to the world of claymation. And we're going to look at the TV special Meet the Raisins, the California Raisins full special that was done in the 80s. Now, we talked a little bit about the California Raisins and we did the Claymation Christmas special a while back. But this is fully fledged. Here are the four characters with their personalities on an adventure. And we're going to deep dive into that as much as we can. I loved the California Raisins as a kid. I watched every piece of media that they had, and I had no idea I was actually being advertised to by a company.
I'm here for it. Okay. I'm excited.
But before we go, I want to once again give a shout out to Nikki for requesting today's episode. And again, happy birthday. I hope that we were what you were hoping. I'd be very sad if it turns out that you're hoping we're going to give, like, a very specific reaction and we've disappointed you.
Oh, gosh. I mean, that happens out here in Hollywood, you know.
Right, yeah. Okay, but if anyone else would like to get a hold of us, you know, we can always be reached through email at adultsomethingsversus@gmail.com, through Twitter at adultversus, and through Facebook. Our theme song is Sell Out by Zombie Apocalypse Now from the EP Forbidden Tales of Science. You can find that and more at antizombierock.bandcamp.com. Now, Ariel, before we go, I want to ask you a quick question. Like, what other fairy tales do you think could use a historic reimagining through the lens of 90s schlaltz?
Oh, like Hansel and Gretel by far.
Oh, man, you know, they actually made
they already did that
crazy horror film, Hansel and Gretel, recently, that apparently was really good and I never saw.
I probably won't see it, but good for them.
Also, they made an action Hansel and Gretel movie starring Hawkeye.
Oh, Jeremy Renner.
Jeremy Renner.
Yeah. Oh, I won't see that.
Yeah, that well might have already been used up. What's the second choice?
Now I'm like trying to think of like freaking fairy tales. Everything I could think of is like, oh, there's a Disney movie. So I don't know.
Well, okay, this Disney movie is Cinderella too, so that doesn't.
Well, I know, but this movie is already. You didn't ask me about this movie, so like, all right. I don't know.
All right, we're just gonna back up the train. I want to go and try to convince Ariel to watch these Hansel and Gretel movies and fulfill the historical accurate itch, because that Jimmy and Renner movie is definitely super historically accurate. But until next time, as always, please do not put a dirty sock in your younger sibling's mouth.
Yeah. Of course not, Mother. I'm only here for the food.